The silent epic western of the 1920s is best remembered, where it's remembered at all, as a cycle inseparable from the very specific national historical framework of its production, a period in the United States noted for its resurgent nationalistic and nativist sentiment. With this tenor of public discourse predicated on the significance of birthright in defining the American came a renewed cultural commitment to the defining philosophy of manifest destiny and in turn the importance of the frontier, the westward migratory experience in shaping the nation's character, institutions, and society. Films like The Covered Wagon, The Iron Horse, North of 36, The Pony Express were, in this moment, acknowledged amongst the foremost vehicles for such sentiment. Has anyone seen any of these films? Okay, that's good. That's the most positive response I've ever had given a paper on this, so excellent. Okay, so all produced between 1923 and the end of the American silent era, these constituted and were popularly acknowledged as a cycle of epic or super westerns to acknowledge the popular sort of nomenclature of that day and give some essential context to what I'm dealing with today. Invariably lavish productions, foregrounding in an ostensibly legitimate fashion the historical reference that many felt had been lost in the backgrounds of the exaggerated prior Western melodramas, the films of this cycle were credited by contemporary critics with salvaging America's increasingly imperiled and increasingly marginaled and, to be honest, seemingly forever imperiled national genre from a decade's descent into what critics had characterized as ceaseless scenario recycling, substandard production values, and excessive violence. We might consider, for example, The Iron Horse, with its at times photographic tableau-like reenactment of the Union of the Union Pacific and Central Pacific Railways in 1869, the recreation of the 1860 founding of the Pony Express in the run-up to secession and civil war in 1925's very imaginatively titled The Pony Express, which was a sort of follow-up to the cycle instituting The Covered Wagon, the astonishing Cherokee Strip land rush sequence that concludes William S. Hart's Tumbleweeds, which sort of an example of a widely observed phenomenon whereby the more conventional sort of star Western melodrama began to incorporate the sort of historical specificity and moments of sweeping human movement that had been so associated with the emergent epic Western, or the climactic flood sequence from The Winning of Barbara Worth, depicting the 1905 formation of the Salton Sea. I did actually have some clips of these that were meant to go along with the descriptions, but had a slight technical failure, so I'll leave this all up to your imaginations. But moving on. We might identify their common appeal to historical veracity, or what was termed authenticity, as perhaps their major defining characteristic. These were narrative retellings of moments central to the sort of Turnerian American self-image: expansion, civilization, the frontier experience, and so on. Writing in retrospect, Jesse L. Lasky, vice president of the Paramount Company, which blazed the trail for such films, would describe their production as historiographical by design, and I quote, "a group of pictures which we plan to make that would tell the absorbing story of this country's growth." And this has certainly been the focus for most approaches to the cycle from the 1920s until today, as we can see on the screen. Echoing the dominant sentiment of the day and decades of popular histories to follow, Kevin Brownlow would later write that, in epic guise, the Western first became historical. So now that we should be at least somewhat clear what we're looking at, these aggrandized Westerns have, for their reaffirmations of the hegemonic narrative of the New World, their visualizations of America's constructive moments, long been acclaimed as a mode of cinema with singular nation-building and community-forging capacities, and analyzed in distinctly introspective terms, contained to how production of monolithically conservative, large-form historical Westerns might have capitalized on a political landscape defined by nationalist fervor. Positioned as middle-brow productions to follow Pierre Bourdieu, these or sanction legitimacy by their reflection of the political taste of the dominant. And perhaps this isn't surprising. Frankly, it strikes me as a sound assessment. Take The Covered Wagon, for instance, the acclaimed first film in the cycle, a Paramount picture which I will look at quite a lot today. It's a wagon train travelogue, it's set on the Pioneer's Trail to Oregon, the American West in 1849. It's an essential American experience and a much celebrated one in relation to the sort of national character. However, it remains that the collective reputation of this island epic Western arguably persisted for the longest away from its US homeland. Long after the cycle ended, filmmakers in East and West alike continued to attest to the impact with which these frontier epics had marked their own productions, most prominently in the growing documentary tradition, as we can see there. Such a legacy invites situating the epic Western success not within the, to my mind, reductive framing offered by solely domestic explanations, but a wider network of international influence, adaptation, and genre development. In fact, I argue that Hollywood studios openly cultivated the epic Western cycle as a testament to cinema's universalizing potential as the so-called Esperanto of the eye. I'm not going to be endorsing this, just to be clear, but presenting early models for transnational history making firmly embedded within the early film industry's pretensions to global cinematic legibility. In turn, these screen histories became a vehicle for promoting what Paramount, the foremost producer of such films, termed world acquaintanceship. A notion that cinema as a mass medium, polyglot and unbound from national and linguistic competencies, might somehow heal the sort of global scars left by the Great War. So I'm really not here to rehash old arguments about cinema being innately polyglot or having this sort of world, I don't know, scar healing power or whatever. But rather, I want to consider how studio strategies of adaptation, textual and paratextual, facilitated the construction of the epic Western as an ostensibly international mode of film production and a vehicle, by extension, for the transnational thinking of its day. An important context for this was a sort of historiographical and philosophical trend emergent in the US, particularly towards the end of the Great War, when writers like Randolph Byrne developed a transnational reading of US exceptionalism, a major element of which was that America's status as what he called a federated ideal emerged from its sort of diversely constituted population, and by extension that America's singularity, its perceived exceptionalism, can only ever be understood in relation to its old world origins, something that more recent scholars have developed further, by acknowledging the transnational norms against which its self-image is constructed, those outside of which it ostensibly stands. Importantly, these intellectual developments coincided with the development of a new artistic medium that many believed to be uniquely adept at promoting international harmony, the motion picture. The central player in its new global network of distribution and influence would be the United States, where major industrial figures, D.W. Griffith, Universal's Carl Laemmle, and most importantly for us here, general manager at Paramount, Walter Wanger, routinely attested to the relationship between what they called artistic transnationalism or cosmopolitanism and world peace. Working under his guidance through much of the 1920s, Paramount would foster a cycle of films described as natural dramas, linked in the popular consciousness by how they apparently utilised cinema's ubiquity to democratise knowledge on an international plane. Carl Brown's 1927 story of a Carolina mountain community, Stark Love, Robert Flaherty's 1931 South Seas production, Taboo, the epic westerns The Vanishing American, 1925, and Redskin, 1929, and Grass, A Nation's Battle for Life, A Nation's Battle for Life, a story of Persian westward migrations to pasture that was, for reasons that might be quite apparent looking at this clip, described by many critics as sort of a Persian covered wagon. These sorts of films he was not alone in arguing could serve as, and I quote again from Wenger, Foreign Office's pervasive mass media histories or proto-documentaries distributed abroad that it was supposed would foreshorten national disparities by fostering a sort of a notional worldwide cultural understanding. So it was very much within this tradition that Paramount came to cultivate the epic Western cycle. I'll just move on from this. So when we're thinking about how these foreign offices might have been established abroad, I want to highlight something that was really at the heart of the silent historical film's pretensions towards universal legibility, the prologue. Staged on an elaborate scale and with pretensions, an overtly didactic function, prologues were a fairly common part of the sort of movie palace experience from about 1912 onwards, shaping reception within the sort of exhibition space. But the ethnographic display organised for The Covered Wagon would become one of the most discussed of the silent era, prepared for the film's premiere at Grauman's Egyptian Theatre, famous Egyptian theatre in Hollywood by General Tim McCoy, later a Western star in his own right at MGM. It featured, and I quote, "For your elucidation, edification, and entertainment, a company of America's native persons, over 30 Arapaho Indians from the Wind River Reservation in Wyoming." Once on stage as part of this prologue, McCoy would discuss with the gathered Arapahos their personal histories, interpreting their sign language for the audience. Several could in fact speak English, some even having been taken decades before as pioneer children. McCoy's insistence on sign language was likely enforced with these sort of ethnographic pretensions in mind, the oversold sense of cultural disparity serving to bolster the indigenous novelty of the show. With McCoy's prologue, the film ran 8 months at Grauman's before moving on to Europe. As its organiser would recall late in life, Paramount Vice President Jesse Lasky was unsure as to how foreign audiences would take it, and suggested if you go over there with the Indians, we might be able to put the picture over. And I think put over is, to my mind, quite a revealing term when we think about historiographical legibility, how different interpretive communities might read or even inform the production of Hollywood epics. To paraphrase a widely read editorial of the era quoted above, what was it that brought foreign audiences to see The Pilgrimage of the Covered Wagon and assured its popular reputation as deliberately and voraciously historiographical, if not a familiarity with or investment in the sort of reified national mythology? Polyglot ambitions such as those we've identified inevitably required some sort of adaptation, such as that provided by the prologue. We see that transportation, movement from one physical context to another, was accompanied by translation in this sense. So with this in mind, McCoy prevailed on his so-called Americans in Hollywood to follow him to London and Paris on the Covered Wagon's international tour, where they would become a central component of a tremendously successful promotional campaign. At the London Pavilion, an appearance by the 20 living North American Indians from USA now encamped in the Crystal Palace grounds was promised before each performance, and screenings would be twice per day. After 3 months in London, a small portion of the American Indian Party split from the main group and travelled to Paris to spend 13 weeks introducing the film. At the London Pavilion, the film would break records by continuing for a further 3 months. Similar scenes, whether locally or centrally organised, would follow further afield and accompany subsequent epic Western releases too. On the right, if it plays, yes. On the right, you can see footage from the encounter between Navajo prologue performers and Maori staged for the promotion of Paramount's 1925 epic, The Vanishing American, retitled, quite tellingly in this context, The Vanishing Race. Such an encounter, to borrow a term from Irene Latini, generated a certain codified authenticity based on a subjugation of cultural specificity to a more general sense of Indianness, one that might have resonated with local understandings of the Maori as a fading other. The insistence on sign language in the aforementioned prologues operated similarly, again on this exploitation of local pre-existing knowledges, or expectations, stereotypes, and so on. So again, in this we see sort of translation, repositioning the mitigated discrepancies in how foreign audiences might receive such products. Prologues and promotion of this sort nuanced and reframed these important screen histories, while in doing so fostering the, albeit very culturally imperialistic, mutual understanding that saw cinema sort of termed the Esperanto of the eye in the sort of editorials that I showed earlier. Now then, I want to sort of round off by highlighting another strategy underpinning the polyglot pretensions of the Foreign Office type film. John Ford's 1924 film is an epic of the Transcontinental Railroad, and today probably the best remembered of the silent epic westerns. Quite unsurprisingly, McCoy and his party were again employed, this time by Fox, to put across the film through prologues. However, as we can see here, in the openings to the domestic and export cuts of Ford's film, left and right, an element of textual reworking also served, in both a material and a figurative sense, to facilitate global consumption and broaden its historiographical legibility. My PC, as I was saying earlier, my PC was playing up a little when I prepared this presentation, so you might notice that these jitter around a bit and skip backwards and forwards, so apologies for that. But anyway, intertitles were fundamental to this sort of portability, materially facilitating the Foreign Office's most celebrated conceit. One basic aspect is the routine elision of specificity in given details, marking the shifting of history into a register where it might otherwise not be heard or register. But perhaps it is here where we see most strongly that studio export strategies didn't merely serve to ease comprehension of some static text, an inviolable universal history, but to articulate what I argue is a transnational model of historical process, an American historical narrative understood from its earliest moments within a frame of reference drawn beyond its national boundaries. Note the contrast between the domestic cut's idealized image of circumscribed national unification in Lincoln, and then in the British print, which expands its historical resonance through the invocation of British railroad pioneer George Stevenson. Embedding in local knowledges didn't just bring accessibility, it generates an expanded model of American development that implicates its old world origins. The two cuts of the Iron Horse tell a common story, the building of the America's Transcontinental Railroad, but as we see through these titles, they tell it to different audiences, radically altering the historical signification of the human activity involved, something that, if you're familiar with the film, you might note places a notable sort of emphasis on the sort of multicultural composition of those involved in building the railroad itself. So this process of adaptation transforms the text into what I'd call a transnational history, or perhaps more properly generates a new historical text predicated on common philosophies, trajectories, and so on, I suppose. By drawing America's future from the European past through the industrial genius of Stevenson, by presenting Manifest Destiny as a concept and continuity transcendent of national boundaries, the export Iron Horse presents a narrative that shares much with contemporary transnational thinking and Paramount's aforementioned natural dramas, such as Grass. The Transcontinental Railroad, like the Persian westward cattle migrations, is the germination of an ambition born in the East. Okay then, to summarise, as I should have time, hopefully. Yes. Okay. We've seen how global ambitions might complicate our understandings of this landmark development in the Western genre, that its histories were national not only in the sense of geography or strident nationalism, but in their capacity to produce images of nationhood for global consumption. We've also seen how they were constructed through prologues and reworking as foreign offices giving an impression of universal historiographical legibility firmly in accord with contemporary notions of transnational cinema and history. Now, I'd like to finish by looking at the rationale for the epic Western success given by the self-professedly British-Hungarian filmmaker Alexander Korda, when he was at his sort of British London film studio in 1933, because I think it's quite useful, to be honest. The films we've looked at today were archetypes for his concept of the international film. Their cumulative vision of nation-building is never presented as what he goes on to call parochial, reliant on a circumscribed public to whom it needs no explanation. However, as I have shown, these were not histories freed from language, many suggested. Rather, by strategically exploiting the mechanisms of a global medium and industry, and illustrating the ready translatability of the silent film format, epic Western producers projected a portable and legible film nation. Thank you.